Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is me.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact scenario.
I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah. This is Tech Talk. Good morning. This is Tech Talk, and this is Michael Tech Talk Kassler on WRLR 98.3 FM in Raleigh Heights, Illinois. Got a great show set up for you here. We're going to have our good friend Jay Geek Trivia Garmin on here in just a little bit. Now, Dave Sparky Saganaki is notably absent, but that's all right. He'll be joining us, I think, next week. And you know, we've got enough stuff to fill in and cover that I think we'll be okay. A lot of stuff happening in technology this week. And also, too, without Dave here, the reason I bring it up is that kind of lets me loose to just talk about pads and tablets and iPads and all that. All I want to, unlike last week when he let it be known right away that he really didn't appreciate it for some reason, didn't wanted to put a stop on it. Now, I promise I'm not going to go on and on and on. I do have, though, at the end of the show, I'll have a couple more iPad apps and even Android apps that I've stumbled across in the last few weeks since I've been using the iPad that are really pretty darn neat. You're going to want to stick around for that. They're really, really very cool stuff that I've been impressed. I have been impressed with the iPad. I have to say, in general, I have been very satisfied with the responsiveness and the breadth and depth of applications that I can get a hold of. Not only the ones that you pay for, and I was concerned that was going to be one of the major differentiators for me with the iPad versus the Android, was I was going to be forking money out of my pocket for everything I wanted to do, whereas with the Android, there's a lot more free stuff out there. It turns out that's not necessarily the case. You have to look a little harder for quality apps that are free, but you can find them. You can also, too, get some really very, very good apps that you pay for. And we recently, the reason we got iPads, it's through my day gig. I work with NEC. We do communication stuff. And the reason why we got the iPads was specifically because the applications that we provide to enterprises allow you to do a lot of communication type stuff with your mobile devices, including iPads. And this gives us an opportunity, and since iPad is the leader in the marketplace right now, this gives us the opportunity to kind of show those products off. And I need my little bell here, ding ding ding, but if you're looking for product of that type, certainly NEC is a great place to go. We just set this up and configured this stuff this last week, and it was surprisingly easy to do. You threw in some applications, made sure our system administrator guy had everything configured on his end, and now I can use my iPad. There's no difference to me anymore whether I'm sitting at my desk, whether I'm out at Starbucks, whether I'm here at the radio station. My phone can be my iPad, my phone can be my cell phone, my phone can be my laptop, or it can be my desk phone. It just makes no difference. There's a lot of cool stuff like that that's going on with the iPads. Like I said, I'm going to talk about some of the very cool apps, non-business, non-work related, that were cool at the end of the episode. Also, too, I'll have to at some point start talking to you guys about the games that I've been having fun with. I know this is not new to anybody that has got an iPad, but boy, have you heard of that draw something? That is addictive. It's the silliest game. It's just goofiness. You draw something, as the name would have you believe, and And somebody else, perhaps somebody you know on Facebook who plays, or perhaps just some random character on the interwebs, tries to guess what it is that you just drew. And then they draw something back to you, and you try to guess for them as well. And it's a lot of fun. And surprisingly, I when I first started doing it, I was thinking, well, this will be good for the kids. I'll test this one out. I'm going to field test it. If I like it, maybe I'll see if I can, get it for the kids. We'll do it for the kids. Well, guess what? The kids have played maybe once, and I've been cranking away on it for a while. So you can check that out. Now, I did find out recently, too, and I hadn't realized this, there is an Android version for this as well. So you can do it on Android or on iPad. It's only OMG Pop is the manufacturer. So I've got my kids now with their Android tablet. Yeah, going against me on the iPad. And like I said, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of other good games, too. Like I said, we'll have to break that down at some point. You know, speaking of Apple, though, I don't know if you realize this, but if you've got an iPod, an iPad, an iPhone, anything kind of with an I in front of it, that was purchased between 2006 and beginning part of 2009, which I guess would not include the iPad. The iPad hasn't been around that long. Then you're probably going to get an email or perhaps something in the mail that's going to give you the option to opt out of a lawsuit that is being filed against Apple. It's a class action lawsuit. Specifically related to their music and to the way that they reacted to websites or products that were designed to allow you to put music onto your iPod, onto your iPhone, without going through iTunes and without going through the Apple Store. The reason, of course, why Apple did this was because of the music service Harmony. Real Networks had Harmony configured, and they set it up as a digital rights management translation service. And what that meant was that you could take music that were downloaded from the Real Player Music Store, and you could translate them into songs that could be played on Apple's iPod. Well, Apple immediately reacted to that and didn't like it and said, you know what, you go ahead and do that, but we're going to block that. We're blocking you and every other music service from uploading songs to your iPod. Sorry, you're going to have to use the iTunes interface, which of course meant that they were able to capture and keep that audience. And so there's now an antitrust lawsuit being filed against Apple, accusing the company of unfairly blocking competition, which it sure sounds like they were. I mean the common sense test says that's a legitimate case to make. Now, there hasn't been any discussion of money that's going to be doled out or handed out depending on how the case is resolved, and of course there wouldn't be until it gets a little bit further along. But there's some discussion and some concern that enough people will be so much Apple fans and so fond of the Jobs legacy that they'll actually recuse themselves from being part of this class action suit and saying we don't want any ill-gotten gains from this type of thing. Leave poor Apple alone. I don't believe that's true. I think most people are going to ignore, just as they always do, these letters that come in. I get these emails and letters fairly frequently. I've gotten one from IBM. I got one from Dell. I was in charge of purchasing for Dell. I get them from HP. You know, all these different different companies wind up being sued some sort of class action. Oh, there's one for I believe Dish Network or something recently as well. And you know that the payout is going to be just minuscule because of, even if the lawyers are successful in receiving a multi-million dollar settlement, well, 50-60% of that goes to the lawyers. of course. And then the additional money that is distributed, you know, if you've got $1 million and you're distributing it among, you know, 10 million people, how much are you going to get? Not a lot. You know, it's less than a buck. By the time you pay postage on that thing, you're not winding up with a lot of cash rattling around in your pocket. And so I think most people kind of ignore these sort of things and just let their life go on. I'd be curious to hear, though, if people want to go on to the facebook.com/TechTalkWRLR site and post and let me know what you think and if you are going to follow through with that. There's a lot of lawsuits and suits and cases in the courts going on right now, of course. Oracle's suing Google, and these are the big gorillas on the block here, and they're battling it out. The reason being that Oracle claims that Google used their Java APIs improperly and that they broke copyright law on it, essentially, that the APIs, which is a programming interface for using the code that's available in the in Java, those are broken. Those are being used. Those are copyrightable, and those are being used improperly by Google in order to create the Android system. And that this could be, you know, it's not something that they would probably wind up in a situation where they'd be shutting down production of Android, but it would be potentially a situation where Google would have to provide to Oracle recompense for, you know, the amounts that they lost because they weren't licensing the Java application interface. And I, this is one of those odd situations here where you get kind of torn about it. Now, already a judge has agreed with some of the case and said that that Oracle should be paid $150,000. For the use that Google made of that Java application. Of course, Java originally was not an Oracle product at the time. When this actually started happening, it was owned by Sun. Now that got absorbed into Oracle, so it's Oracle that's pursuing the case. Oracle has turned down that statutory damages essentially, and said, you know what, you can keep the 150. That's peanuts. We're going after the big kahuna. And to some degree, they're absolutely right. 150 grand to Google or to Oracle is nothing. I mean, that's in fact, that is less than what Google spends on providing lunch for its employees for any given 5-day period. So a week's, it's a week's worth of lunch money for them. and that's all that they'd get. So Oracle says, forget it. Now, when that occurred, one of the judges essentially ridiculed Oracle and said that that Oracle is being outrageous, thinking. In fact, he actually used the phrase. He said, "This is the height of ridiculousness." This is Judge Alsup. The height of ridiculousness to think that they could receive hundreds of millions of dollars for nine lines of code that are in question here. And in fact, he told the Oracle prosecution team, he said, the law can't operate that way, and in my mind, you are making a mistake. Now the response to that, and the legal team is headed by a guy named David Boyes, who's representing Oracle, defended the strategy, saying, and again, I'm quoting here, he said, Boyes said, "What we are saying is that once you have proved infringement, we believe that under the law we have claim for an infringer's profit case." I don't know. You start getting real deep into legal jargon and things like this. But I think the main point is that Oracle wants to take a stab at Google, knock them down a notch or two. They've got a chance at making a lot more than lunch money off of this. So I guess, you know, why not? Why not? You know, that's the way, this is just the way things work these days, I guess. So, oh, you know, no, I'll come back to that later. I was going to, you know, we were talking about legal suits and so on. I had forgotten, though, there was a reason why I brought the iPad up earlier. I'm going to go back on it here. I normally like to kind of segue smoothly, but I'm going to bounce a little bit here today since I'm on my own. So I've got an iPad. iPads are great. I was talking about communication tools on the iPad. There was a point to that other than just talking about it. Communication with your iPad. It happens. It works. Not only that, but monkeys can do it too. Orangutans, in fact, at the Miami Zoo, the old man of the jungle right there, he's using the iPad to communicate. That's right. You know, one of the big issues with communicating with monkeys is many times we've struggled because of this language barrier, and we've taught monkeys, we've taught some of the apes, chimpanzees and so on, to sign, and the orangutans as well, and even to utter something almost resembling human speech, not close enough to really have any sort of discussion. So this now is allowing them to make more of an outreach to the orangutans. There's 5 orangutans. 35-year-old Connie. This is at the Miami Zoo. 33-year-old Sinbad. 14-year-old Hannah. And 12-year-old Jake. Oh, and one more. Two more. 8-year-old twins, Peanut and Pumpkin. Now, they were first given iPads last summer. And originally, they were just allowed in the cage and desensitizing them to this new thing that they had. And then the trainers started asking them to touch the iPad without pulling it, trying to grab it and pull it into the cage. They really were trying to show them, you know, and introduce them to the concept of touching something and having it interact and respond to them. And it's funny, is that the older orangutans are just not interested in doing it. One of the trainers said that he compares the two older ones to his parents. He keeps trying to get them to use the iPad, but they're just not interested. They don't get it. The other ones, the younger orangutans, very much like younger individuals here in human world, are very excited about it. They have to take turns getting to use it, and they all want to be the first one to handle it. And they're already starting to communicate with it. They can ask them questions and say, what type of food would you like? And they can identify, you know, coconut. They can identify banana on there and indicate what it is that they want for their lunch that day. So, you know, and it's going from there. There's actually an organization called Orangutan Outreach, and they're currently working on this with donated iPads at other zoos as well. So it could be that someday in the near future here, and I'm talking just next couple of years, you may go to your zoo and not just get to look at the monkeys and look at the animals and see the orangutans and all this thing, but they may be able to talk back to you too. You may get a tour from one of these guys, which I think would just be amazing, an amazing thing. Talk about communications with an alien. We've got aliens right here. We can talk to them right now. And that's going to be an interesting thing. Of course, there's a famous quote, and I'm trying to recall in the depths of my memory where it comes from. It's from one of the writers or philosophers, an English character, who wrote. He said, "If we could speak to a lion, we could still not understand him. Or even though a lion could speak, we would still not understand him." And so it'll be interesting to see how far communication with an orangutan can occur. Is our life experience so vastly different that it's not going to make any difference if we actually get some of these things other than real basic communications back and forth? You know what time it is? Speaking of talking and whether or not we can understand somebody, I think we need to bring our good friend Jay Garman on here. I'm going to try to bring him in right now. See if we can do that. We got this new thing set with Skype where... good morning. There he is. I was just saying, we got this new thing with Skype where we just don't hear any ringing at all. It just comes right up, which is... is still a little surprising to me every time it happens.
Well, yeah, it's good to know we can keep you on your toes.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Man, oh, I think, and we've got something going on here with our side, I think, where the you're very, very scratchy when you're speaking.
Well, it could just be that your Skype doesn't like people from the South, you know, and it's trying to impose some sort of 1930s Coen Brothers old-timey sort of filter on us.
And it's working very, very well. Hey, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hang us up. I'm going to call you right back. I'm going to see if maybe just this connection for some reason was poor. We typically have very good response with Skype, so I'm hoping that'll do it. Jay, I'm going to hang up on you. I'm going to ring you back within the next 30 seconds.
Cool.
Yep. Yeah, that's no good. We can't have a show with Jay with that kind of thing going on. And I notice there's a lot of goofiness going on right now here with stuff. So I'm gonna try to get a few things cleared up on the side here. All right, let's give that one more try here and see how that works.
Hello.
Ah, that's much, much better. And interestingly, we actually heard a ring that time. So... So, I don't know what's going on. I give up anymore. It worked.
It's a good thing this show isn't actually about technology and how to use it properly. Otherwise, that would be embarrassing.
No, exactly. You know, I like to see us an example of the negative. We're the way you don't want to run technology, and that in itself is instructive. We're the bad example of tech usage.
The cautionary tale, if you will.
Exactly. And I think as that, you know, we do a good job of that, and that's a useful thing. That's a useful thing to be.
Well, we're really good at it, so let's hope it's useful.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Extremely, extremely good. Well, you know, we on the stuff that people can't see or hear, we actually do pretty well. I've usually got most things working behind the scenes pretty smoothly. It's always the stuff that actually gets recorded that people do hear that doesn't work the way that it should. That's an issue. But everything else, I've got my this week, in fact, in particular, my laptop's all powered up. We've got news queued up. We were just talking again about iPads a little bit, but more about all of the lawsuits that were going on recently, and all this. Now, I have to ask you. I've had some discussions with authors and about the suit between Apple and Amazon and the all the stuff going on with the price fixing of the ebooks and all that. And I was curious what your belief on that was, what your stance was on ebooks and how they should be charged.
My issue with ebooks is I don't think there is one right price for ebooks. And I think that's where the problem gets in is there's very clearly some predatory pricing or some price dumping going on, especially on Amazon as part to try and expedite adoption of ebooks. It would have happened anyway, naturally, through the market eventually, but they're sort of trying to force it to happen, and naturally the brick and mortar forces are trying to push back against that in much the same way the newspaper industry pushed back against websites. So that's clearly not going to work. But I sort of go with some guys I talked to, Pablo Defendini, who used to work for Tor and does a lot of good stuff, and Tobias Buckel, who's a sci-fi author who's done a lot of really interesting experiments with his own ebook pricing, and J.C. Hutchins, who does a lot of transmedia stuff and is a self-publishing guy, that there isn't a one right price. That the right price for Stephen King is not the right price for a first-time author trying to break out in a niche, you know, genre. The right price for textbooks isn't the right price for fiction, just as it is in real books. So this notion that there is some sort of universal price floor or universal price ceiling for ebooks, I think, is wrong on its face.
Yep.
And everyone else sort of trying to impose their model on what the right price for ebooks is wrong. I don't think there should be any price forcing. I think that you should be able to, you know, move it up and down during the life of the book, based on who the author is, based on the genre, that sort of thing. I think that's sort of the problem, is that everyone's sort of trying to guard their little slice of the pie and say, you know, it must be this price because I make X, or it must be this price so that we can get Y market share. And I think that's wrong as a universal statement.
Yeah, well, and it's, you know, that's a really interesting point. I hadn't really thought of it that way before. I mean, you're forced into this sort of set price for books, you know, actual real paper books, where the price is set at the time of imprint, and that's what goes out, and that's what it's sold at, essentially. I mean, you know, there's, of course, there's various, you know, ways that money is divvied up and all this, but basically, you know, you've got your paperback book, and it's, I haven't bought a paperback book at, like, at a Barnes & Noble's and so on. I don't know what they are anymore, but I assume it's, like, about $8.95 or something these days, and that's going to be the same whether you bought that book as soon as it was released and shows up on the stand, or if you buy it 6 months later, or, you know, regardless of how well the book has done, regardless of whether that's the first time you've heard of this author or not. But that's not the case, and doesn't have to be. I mean, it's possible and very, very practical to manage the cost of books in an ebook format.
Absolutely. Well, and what also is completely screwing up ebooks, and authors have a really hard time with this because they make a lot of money off of it traditionally, are foreign rights markets, or even if they're not translation rights. You know, I know a whole bunch of authors who I've talked to who get totally separate contracts and get totally separate rates and totally separate release dates for their U.S. rights and their British rights, and they basically get paid twice for the same work, whereas there's really not a great deal of difference in the product, but that goes back to the days when you physically had to ship books overseas, and you had to get it in a whole different set of bookstores, and all that sort of thing, and there was an actual delay. It's a legacy of that, but ebooks are really screwing with that, because, you know, when you've got a Kindle, and you've got to put in your address of where you live, and it literally blocks you from buying some books at Amazon.co.uk because they haven't been U.S. released yet.
Yep.
And that's just bizarre to some people.
Yep.
And some authors are like, that's asinine. I should be able to, when I release my books in English, anyone who speaks English should be able to buy them from anywhere. But then there's other authors who are like, no, I want to get paid twice. I want to get paid by the British distributor, and I want to get paid by the American distributor. I want my double dip of money. And so that gets really weird with ebooks, because there's really no reason for that to be at all.
Yes. Yeah, and actually, in fact, it was interesting. We had on an author a little while ago from Australia, and had run into this Simon Haynes, and he felt that way too. He's like, it's ridiculous. You know, the book is out there, and he in fact actually sent me copies of his books, even though they weren't released in America, because he's like, it's just ridiculous that I've written a new book. You can't read it. You can't buy it until that process is made. Now, I think you mentioned, too, you know, difference between nonfiction and fiction books. And I think one thing that I see, and I may be reaching here, but I believe that there's a difference in the way that individuals who write nonfiction books, and by nonfiction I mean specifically more of the, like, you know, computer how-to kind of books, you know, the Twitter for Dummies kind of thing, the way that those individuals create those books and want them to be distributed is definitely more focused on the commoditization of that work, and certainly the return from the effort on that work. Whereas when I speak to people who are writing fiction and who are writing books that are more from the creative aspect, seem to be much more interested in just, hey, this needs to be out there. Yes, I want to make enough to live on so I can keep doing this thing. This is what I want to have happen. But the point is to get this out. Do you see that? Does that hold true? Or is there a sense of commoditization on the fiction side too?
No, I think the real difference between those two is that technical nonfiction, you know, instructional text of any kind, have a much shorter shelf life of relevance and usefulness than fiction. We're still reading Shakespeare. Nobody's reading How to Network Windows NT.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make your money so much faster with technical or instructional nonfiction than you do with fiction. In fact, a lot of fiction authors, their whole concern is they want their ebook rights to sunset with the publisher, so that when they, you know, they're 20 years into their career, that Peter David can go back and not the Star Trek stuff, obviously, because there's some rights out of there, but all his old fiction that he wrote in the early 90s, mm-hmm. that the publishers have no interest in putting back into print, he can release his ebooks and keep making, you know, oh, you've just discovered me because of my latest Star Trek novel. Well, here's all the stuff I've written for the last 20 years. How about you go buy it?
Yeah.
That's great for Pete, but, you know, the guy who wrote, you know, How to Manage Microsoft Money in 2000, that product doesn't even exist anymore. They got out of that market. Like, you can't even buy that software. It doesn't exist.
Yep.
So that guy had to make his money as fast as he could. So the ebook rights to that, like, the whole idea that you would wait to do that in Britain differently than you do it here, that guy's screaming, like, release it everywhere as fast as you can.
Yep.
get it out.
Yeah. Well, and there's also, too, there's a different, and that's where you start getting into this real tangible difference between paper books versus ebooks, is that there is a translation process that has to occur if you've got a tremendous amount of, you know, the picture's worth 1,000 words in those type of situations. And the Kindle and that is just not that good at displaying graphics and images in a way that is usable as a reference tool. And it's also, too, because it's a single sheet display, you have books that are designed specifically to have, you know, a picture on one side and text referring to it on the other. And that also just doesn't happen on a lot of the ebooks that are out right now.
No, because, again, you're taking something that was designed for physical printing in a specific typesetting situation, which is often far more true of technical nonfiction than it is of fiction, and then just, you know, sort of ramming it, you know, square peg and round hole, shoehorning it into the ebook version. I think technical nonfiction, especially college textbooks, which frankly I think is why the Justice Department really got involved, is they don't really care that much about fiction market. Really, they're not that big a deal. What they really care about is the cost of textbooks.
Yep.
They have a real vested interest in that from the educational standpoint. And I think that's where some real innovation is set to happen. As we start designing textbooks, say, for the iPad, but more importantly, you change the whole pricing model. Whereas, if I'm working in I got Ruby on Rails programmers at my job, and instead of them buying this year's O'Reilly, you know, guide to Ruby, they could buy a yearly subscription to the O'Reilly Guide to Ruby, and that ebook could continuously update and stay in sync with the new versions of Ruby. As the new gems get pushed out to the open source community, the text could update live. Like, it doesn't, this whole notion that ebooks have to stay these static objects,
mm-hmm.
I think is just old thinking.
Yep.
That doesn't have to be true, and that could totally revolutionize instructional texts online.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No. I think that's a great point. And now I've used both my Kindle and my iPad now for reading instructional text. I'm taking classes in the evening to get my MBA and all this. So I get these enormous books that if I buy them in paper, they're, you know, an inch and a half thick. They're just ridiculous to carry around. Now I tried though getting them on the Kindle, and found it less than useful that way. There's really something about having that physical book and being able, it does assist your memory where you are in the book, that physical heft of it, and also to being able to flip back and forth from the glossary to the contents and so on was much easier physically. But I do find that on the iPad, it's much, much closer to that physical experience, particularly when reviewing PDFs and some of these other documents, close enough that I'm willing to explore the idea of doing textbooks on the iPad, where I had given it up with the Kindle.
Yeah, well, the Kindle, again, is designed, especially the classic Kindle, is designed as a paperback fiction replacement. It's not designed for anything else. That's really just what it was for, because it was aimed at the people, the hardcore, just have so many books in their house, they're out of house.
Yep.
They buy 200 books a year. That's who the Kindle is designed for, and those are rabid fiction consumers. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. That is a use case driven device.
Yep.
If you try and expand it, it's just like there's no one book design that works for all books. There's no one book reader design that works for all books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and that's exactly right. And I still use the Kindle for exactly that. I mean, I probably purchase, I'm not around 200, but I'm probably around 100 fiction books, even taking the classes that I do. And it's beautiful for that. It's just absolutely ideal. If I could just convince United to let me keep it turned on while we were taxiing, I'd be overjoyed. But it really is perfect for that situation. The only time I ever get frustrated with the Kindle in that environment is if I'm reading an author like Pratchett, who has quite a few footnotes, depending on how the book was taken up into the Kindle. Sometimes they're done very nicely where you can link through to them, and sometimes they're not done so well, and all of a sudden you get to the end of a chapter and there's 15 footnotes that are out of context. but in general, the Kindle's perfect for that situation.
Absolutely, which is what it was designed for. Mm-hmm. They got that right. The Kindle Fire is a whole separate issue, because it's basically just a shrunken Android tablet.
Yes.
Which is a whole separate kettle of fish. I really think that we're the next 10 years is the next big leap in ebooks in terms of pricing and design, just because they're really starting to overtake paperbacks in a serious way in terms of consumption. And getting back to the pricing issue, what's really getting weird, and why Amazon really likes the 99-cent price point for a lot of stuff, is they're noticing this behavior between hardcore readers where they buy books they never read. Now, that was true of physical books, but the 99-cent price point is for a compulsive reader is to the point where they don't even think about buying it. It's like, I might read that someday, I'll go ahead and buy it now.
Yeah.
And they really, really notice this is that Amazon catches you if you try to buy the same book twice. And it's not an unusual behavior for that class of reader. If they've bought so much stuff, they've forgotten what they bought.
Yes, yes. And I.
And so when they come across it again in their recommendations, they'll try and buy it again.
I have done that. I have done that more times than I can recall. Not since I've gotten my Kindle, but in the past with paperback books, authors that I particularly loved, I would go and accidentally I couldn't. It had been long enough since I had read the work that I couldn't recall if I had read it, and I would wind up purchasing it again. And then you get to chapter 2, chapter 3, and you're like, oh, son of a gun. And I think publishers would do that intentionally, though, is that they would, not intentionally to try and trap people like myself, but they would re-release the book. The book would have a new cover. It would have new, new bylines. It would have new, new information on the outer covers of it that would make it look and feel very much like a new work of fiction. And it wouldn't be until you looked in and all that. I started being very rigorous in checking the copyright dates of books that I was picking up at the bookstore in order to avoid that situation.
Well, that's the next big thing that Charles Stross has written about this recently, so of course I have to talk about it because I'm a complete Stross fanboy, but this whole notion that a book has one cover or a book has one release strategy or one jacket. When you talk about ebooks, first off, the whole notion that the books were designed so you could put them on one shelf in one physical bookstore. If it was sci-fi and fantasy, it went in sci-fi and fantasy. It doesn't matter if it had romance in it. It doesn't matter if it's young adult. It doesn't matter if it also has a mystery in it. It has to go on one shelf. Where does it go? in an online store, that's totally not true. It can be organized in mystery and young adult and romance and sci-fi fantasy, and it can have different book jackets and different cover blurbs and different descriptions in all of those locations.
Yep.
So you can literally sell the same book six different ways if you want to in an online version, which you just can't afford to do in a physical book.
Yep.
Which, again, no one has really chased except possibly Harry Potter. Harry Potter famously had the youth-oriented covers and the adult-oriented covers so that adults could read them on the subway and not be embarrassed.
Yes, yes.
And they did that for physical books, but almost no one else does that.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that gets us into a whole other kettle of fish talking about, you know, genres, the point of genres. And one of the things that struck me recently looking at Kindle, the top Kindle free books. And I went in there and I was looking to see, you know, I wanted some books for my kids. I was thinking, oh, you know, some of those some of the old school sci-fi stuff that's out of copy right now, you know, I can pick up some of this. But you look at the top 100 purchased free Kindle books, and yeah, there's a couple Sun Tzu, Art of War, there's Sherlock Holmes, I think, is in that list, but by far and away the great bulk of the books that are popular that are free are these knockoff Harlequin-esque romance novels that, you know, when you say they're a dime a dozen, I mean, they're actually literally going for free on Kindle at this point. And it makes you, you know, there's, I guess, a need for that genre definition so that people are comfortable getting exactly what they want to get. But but we're running out of time. Like I said, I think that's going to be a topic for another show, where I'll have to listen to one of the sci-fi podcasts that that are much, much better at discussing fiction works and that type of thing than we are.
Well, yeah, I think my boys over at SF Sing are actually doing that subject this week. So on ebook pricing. So once I listen to that, I'll get all their good wisdom and I'll regurgitate it for the next show.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic! I'll have to listen to that as well. When does that podcast release, by the way?
Whenever Patrick Hester gets around to it, the schedule I think you would be sympathetic to.
I was just going to say that's perfect. I completely and absolutely understand that. SF Signal though is a fantastic. It's one of those podcasts better than ours. If you're listening to this one, you probably want to jot that down and say, hey, you know what? I need to go listen to that one too, or pull out your phone and just subscribe to it right now, because you can grab it through iTunes and you can grab it through their website to RSS feed, or get that link and pop it into whatever your favorite podcatcher is at the moment. I use Dogcatcher, which is fantastic. It was one of the few things that I actually was willing to plunk some money down, is that I listened to enough podcasts that that was a worthwhile investment for me. And of course now I'm in Apple's walled garden and I'm being forced to use iTunes for my podcasting again, which I have to confess is not that terrible. It works. It does the things that I need it to. And now that I figured out how to get my iPad to synchronize through Wi-Fi automatically with the iTunes stuff, it's actually pretty decent. Pretty decent.
It's a gilded cage, but it's still a cage.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Jay, we're at a quarter two, and we haven't even brought up the topic or subject of trivia. Last week, we had, I'm trying to recall. Now, I remember the answer to last week's trivia, but what was the trivia we were supposed to think about this week?
This week was what circumstances brought about the need
for
the Supreme Court of the United States to rule that a tomato is in fact a vegetable.
That's right. We got an answer from Customer Jones, of course, which she put up on the facebook.com/techtalkwrlr page. I didn't read it. I brought up the whole Reagan thing in the 80s that I recall. But this was decided back in the late 1800s, and what did they come up with?
Again, this is just like the X-Men not being human. This is another case of import levies. Fruits and vegetables were under the Tariff Act, were taxed at different rates for coming into the country.
Mm.
And fruits were cheaper than vegetables, so a bunch of tomato importers wanted to have tomatoes taxed at the fruit rate, because botanically, they are fruit. And it was, the case was called Nix versus Hedden, which sounds like two supervillains fighting.
Yep.
And the Supreme Court ruled it doesn't matter what the technical definition is. In the case of taxation law, the common consensus definition is what applies. Most people think tomatoes are vegetables, therefore the law goes with that. Therefore, tomatoes, as far as the law is concerned, are vegetables, and it doesn't matter what science says.
Excellent.
So therefore, according to the Supreme Court, public opinion is more important than science.
Fantastic. And they took that to heart when they were coming up with the textbooks down in Texas. And, Oh, man. I love the way that our politicians really feel that reality is a very flexible construct, that we can just bend and shape that to our will, to the public will, and all that. That's fantastic. So Reagan was really going against the grain. I thought for sure. No, he didn't. He kept it. He said, yeah, ketchup is a vegetable too, since it's made from tomatoes, which are now legally vegetables.
Well, they did that because they wanted to count it as part of the food groups in the nutritional guidelines they give to schools. That if we serve it, the fries with ketchup, that counts as a serving as vegetables.
Like, that's right.
What? Again, I think that would be a case if you went to the Supreme Court. The consensus of the public would be, you're crazy.
Exactly. And I think it did wind up getting kicked out fairly quickly thereafter. Man, and I'm sure Customer Jones nailed it. Suzanne, I'll read what you posted today. Now that I know the answer, and what should she post for this next week?
Well, yesterday was the 15th anniversary of the supercomputers finally defeating a grand chess champion under normal tournament rules. Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov in 1997, 15 years ago this week. So I'm going to do a chess theme one. That was a big step forward for chess playing supercomputers, because the first version of chess ever played by a computer had to be dumbed down. They had to literally make a special variant version of chess so that computers could handle it. So the question is, what special version of chess was the first version ever played by a computer program?
And this is one that was played by an actual legitimate computer program, not by a dwarf in a box pretending to be a computer program.
No, not a Mechanical Turk, an actual computer program.
All right. Excellent. No, that is a great question. Yeah. And now, of course, you know, they've solved checkers. Checkers is no longer a computer's been designed to play checkers perfectly. So it cannot be beaten.
Well, and this is a discussion for another time, but there's under game theory, there's multiple definitions of solve. So as I understand it, checkers has been weakly solved, which is to say that if it plays from a standard position beginning, it will always at least draw.
Yes.
There's other ways. A perfectly solved game is the computer could take over at any point in a game and always win.
Oh, interesting. So tic-tac-toe would fall into the weakly solved game then. Okay, interesting. I did not realize there was multiple levels. Maybe we can talk about that more next week when we're discussing the original weakened versions of chess that were originally played. That's a great question. I'm an amateur chess player myself, who's rated and all that great stuff. So I love discussion of the chess stuff. That always intrigues me, learning more about that.
Me too. It's a great mathematical exercise, although it will not get you chicks.
No. Unfortunately, the cheerleaders that do show up at the chess games in high school. It never did work out. At any rate, Jay, I'm going to let you go on that note. I still got to play spots and all that, and I promise some good iPad apps for cool sites of the week this week. Thanks, as always, for coming on. And we'll tune into Sci-Fi Signal and learn more about Amazon price fixing and ebooks and all that.
All right, take it easy, buddy.
All right, you too. Thanks, Jay. Take care.
Bye.
Jay Garman, jaygarman.net. You can find out more about him there. What a great guy to have on the show. Love always hearing from him. And he did mention that Sci-Fi Signal. I know plugging somebody else's show. How lame is that of me? That's fine. That show is good enough. If you're listening to that, I think there's enough crossover and great stuff going on over there. I would just love to have you listen to it, and of course you'll be hearing more Jay on there as well. It's always good stuff. So I am going to play us a few spots and promos and good stuff like that. You are not going to want to tune away, though. You're not going to come back to Tech Talk on WRLR, because we're going to have some cool sites of the week and a podcast only song of the week as well coming at you in just a minute. So don't go away.
You're listening to 98.3 FM, WRLR LP, Round Lake Heights, Illinois.
The law firm of McGee, Negley & Associates of Round Lake, Illinois is a proud sponsor of WRLR. Their attorneys advise clients in areas of bankruptcy, real estate law, foreclosure defense, litigation, and general practice matters. The law firm of McGee, Negley & Associates is located at 444 North Cedar Lake Road in Round Lake, Illinois. Their phone number is 847-546-0055. Their website is McGeeNegley.com.
In Washington today, the president's popularity continued its pace. The most recent poll taken by Blah Blah Magazine and Blah BC News shows Blah 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 Blah.
Looking for local news you can use?
With more on that, here's Blah Blah Blah.
Blah 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 Blah.
The Lake County Journal hits newsstands each Thursday, and it's filled with features, sports, news stories that cover your community. Daily updates can also be found at lakecountyjournal.com, where readers can view photo galleries, post comments, and read blogs. The Lake County Journal, your life connected.
All right, we are back. And let's see, what do we have going on here? Oh, that's right, I remember now. We were going to do a little bit of cool sites of the week. Although these days now we're doing a few more of the cool apps of the week. Although I do have a cool site or two to give you as well. Now I'm going to start it off though with a cool app of the week. This one is very, very cool. One of the things that I've been doing with my iPad, do a lot of stuff with PowerPoints, but I also too, I'm still a Windows guy, and I got to do my stuff with Windows. I got to be able to do, I got my Microsoft Word applications, I got PowerPoint and all that. And so I've been hunting around for some good ways to make that happen easily on the iPad. And guess what? I found some, and not only did I find some, but I found some that are free. You can get into them for free. Now, they're freemium in that if you want advanced features or more storage space and things like that, you're going to pay a little bit, but you can get into them easily for free. The first one I'm going to talk to you about here is, if I can find it, I'm looking for it right now, is called OnLive Desktop. Now, this is going to look probably the most familiar to you and the most comfortable to you if you're coming from a Windows environment. The reason being, it looks and is a Windows environment. Essentially what OnLive Desktop is a it's like a Citrix Zen desktop sort of setup where you're actually running Windows 7 on somebody else's server somewhere and being allowed to access it. And it's got Office 2010 installed. It's got cloud storage for documents that you can access, that you load them up into the OnLive desktop space. And then you can work on them and edit them and manage them just as though you were sitting in front of your home Windows Windows 7 computer, and it's nifty. I mean, it's slick. When you show it to people, it takes a little while to boot up, but then when you show it to people, they're like, wow, that's cool. You've got Windows 7 on your iPad, and it is pretty neat. You can also access the internet through their internet connection, that type of thing. So there's some neat things, and if you're looking for ways to, for example, you know, get around some blocks, I imagine this would be a way to do it. You know, we at my house, I've got OpenDNS configured on the router, so a lot of crazy sites are blocked from the kids. But if they knew about this, they'd be able to sneak right around that OpenDNS and get through to whatever site they wanted to. So something to be aware of if you have kids as well. When you've given them an iPad, yes, you can lock down a lot of their basic internet access, but there's always a way for the smarter kids to get around the stuff, and that's one of them. But at any rate, the main thing though about this here, like I said, is on live desktop, cool stuff. From what I understand, they are getting sued though, so we'll see how long they last. I've also too run into some real slowdown issues where all of a sudden in the middle of the evening it just drags and does disconnect. So be aware of that too. You may not want to try to use it as you know, your one go-to application for managing your documents, because you might run into a bit of a headache. However, there's another one I found that I like even better, and this one is called CloudOn, and you go to site.cloudon.com. Now the way that CloudOn works is it does not attempt to create its own cloud storage. It does not send you really using you know, the full desktop experience. What it does is gives you, you link it in with your Dropbox or you link it in with your Google Docs, and then you choose the document that you want to edit. If it's a Microsoft Word document or similar, it's going to bring up Microsoft Office Word 2010 into your screen, and that's the only application that you have access to while you're working on it. And you can do all the things that you use Office 2010 to do, and then save it back, and it saves it right back into your cloud. It doesn't put it out on someplace else. It saves it in your own personal private cloud. Now, differently from the other one, it doesn't, like I said, create a full desktop. It's really just doing this, you know, a cloud app access, and it's similar technology, extremely similar on the back end, but to you as a user, the feel is a little more integrated into your iPad access. Now, some of the issues you're going to have with it, I'm sure just as I do, is trying to get some of the tabs to operate properly and get your finger in just the right spot can be frustrating. So keep that in mind again while you're using that. All right, I'm going to do one last app here for you, and then we'll move on. Now you've probably heard of Instapaper. Instapaper is a way that you can save documents and websites and things that you run across for reading later, and it's good. I like it. I used it with the Android. I used it on my desktop, but I have to be honest, I didn't use it that much because I just found it a little less useful than I needed it to be. But I've come across a new one that you may not have heard of. It's called Pocket. Pocket is fantastic. It used to be called Read It Later. It's called Pocket now. It works and integrates directly into Flipboard and any other app. You can also too have a little link that you put on your Firefox or Internet Explorer or Chrome installation, and it lets you save web pages that you run across into Flipboard. I'm sorry, not into Flipboard, into Pocket. And then there's an app, or you can go to the website, and they designed it so that it is really slick and really nice and easy to read these articles. It looks like a little magazine that you're reading, like Flipboard does, I guess, in that way. And so it's neat, but it's your own private little installation. And so that's really good stuff. I'm going to leave you with that. We're really running right up against the end of time here. And I'm going to leave you with a cool song, podcast only song of the week, and the one this week, I thought this was just great. I liked it a lot. I don't know if you've heard it yet. I had not heard of these guys until recently. I'm not sure how exactly even to pronounce their name, but I believe it's pronounced Gotye, G-O-T-Y-E, and the song is somebody that I used to know. Boy, it's a bit of a depressing song. It's about a relationship that has failed. But it's a great song. And thank you so much for listening this week to Tech Talk on WRLR. Shouts out to Jay Garman. Thanks for coming on and letting us take up most of your Saturday. And keep on listening. Stay tuned to WRLR. We got fantastic stuff all the time on here. And you can find more about Tech Talk. Go to techtalk.wrlr.fm or facebook.com/techtalkwrlr. Have a great week, guys. Tune into us next Saturday, same time, same bat channel.
Said you felt so happy you could die. I told myself that you were right for me, but felt so lonely in your company. But that was love and it's an ache I still remember. It was over.